Please collect yourself, close your eyes. I think it would be advisable tonight to close your eyes unless you are incredibly tired. And then I would recommend, of course, to keep them open and maybe looking at the blank wall, at an area where there's not any thought activity stimulated, which usually happens through objects. We're so used to fixate objects and then start into mental proliferations around those objects. So just relax, relax the gaze. And for all of us, eyes open or closed, for all of us, just relax within yourself. We're not here, we're not doing this to gain a particular fantastic result. We're just here to attend to our momentary experience very closely, very intimately. Using our attention in a particular way. I mean, of course, whenever we are talking about the direction of attention, there's different ways how we can do that. Our intention could be, for example, extremely focused, one-pointed, so to speak. Or it could have a more broader quality, more all-encompassing quality, taking in a lot of impressions happening simultaneously. I would even suggest that those two modes of attention don't necessarily exclude each other, especially as you have been maybe a little active today in the course of the day. I would recommend that you collect your mental, emotional energies in one particular area, one particular point. I very much like to recommend your physical body, using your physical body as an area to direct your attention towards. Starting with the posture, feeling your whole body as you're sitting here from top to bottom. Noticing what the overall impression is like of being within this particular body. And this is, of course, for all of us, very individual, very different. Only we can know the present state of affairs within our bodies. And we don't really mind whatever the state of affairs is like. If the body is already completely relaxed and attentive, or if the body is rather a little bit tensed, maybe even contracted, tight. We're simply noticing that. The quality of our attention can be a very powerful tool if we know how to direct it in the right way, without interfering with willpower too much, trying to change things which we don't like, which we don't appreciate. Or we start to yearn for something which we don't have right now. What we prefer. If we have pain, we'd rather have something more pleasant, of course, it's very natural. But we don't go into this trap. simply noticing unpleasantness, pleasantness. In this context, they're of equal value. We don't follow our preferences or our aversions. Maybe for some of you now, it's also a good time to letting the breath, the sensations which are triggered by the breathing, come more into focus. That can help you to stabilize your attention within the body. And still also at the same time as we're focusing, say if we focus on an area of breathing, we're also keeping a very alert mindfulness operating of the so-called interferences or obstacles or even defilements in Buddhist parlance. It might just be momentary impulses who just pop up. And if we don't engage them, we don't add any commentary or don't fight with them, they also pop away again. Quite effortlessly, we don't need to do anything. This kind of way of giving ourselves attention, usually we're getting an answer or a resonance from the whole system, from the whole body-mind system. If we have the feedback that we're getting more tensed up, more tight or contracted, then we are probably overdoing it with the application of effort, straining ourselves unnecessarily. And if we're on course, so to speak, then the system gives us some good feedback, some good resonance. We can enjoy this very simple activity of giving ourselves this benevolent, wholesome form of attention, not expecting anything, really being connected with the somatic experience as it unfolds. And all the mental voices or emotional impulses which might want to come in, interfere, and occupy our minds, we don't create stories out of them. We don't engage with them. Simply quickly noting, and then we're back on track. Today we were talking about the birds here, which we have been feeding here in the backyard of Dhammapala and watching them. We can always see that when they pick little kernels and seeds from the ground, of course they have to be very careful not to miss them with their little beaks. At the same time, they have to be very circumspect. If they are very circumspect to any potential danger. So if a potential cat would come around the corner, it would immediately notice it and be up and away on the next branch. And so I thought there's a nice analogy for us. Also in meditation, sometimes we can be focused on what we really want to direct our attention towards. at the same time we noticing any interferences. In the same way that the cat wasn't engaged with the bird, as the bird wouldn't engage with the cat, that would be silly, we wouldn't engage with the defilements or the distractions or anything which comes up and wants to take us away from our area of attention. So we are knowing what is happening in a very comprehensive way. And this is the kind of knowledge in the Buddha Dharma, which is very much emphasized by the Buddha himself, even. It's not one-sided intellectual knowledge, and knowledge which is, one could say, more embodied as a whole human being we know with each pore, each part of ourselves. So this kind of knowing one could also call intuition, an intuitive knowing, or as our teacher Rinpoche Sayadaw calls it, intuitive awareness. This is not something vague and foggy, where we don't know where we are, but it's quite clear and sharp, can be quite clear and sharp. So see for yourself. Stay awake. If your posture collapses, pull yourself up again. Don't go into a trance, please. So the rest of the time I leave you to yourself, please stay with it. Or come back to it if you got on a sidetrack. Inspire yourself. So please stretch yourself for a moment. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, I do hope you all enjoyed this half an hour of silent, quiet meditation. And whatever happened, whatever was on your screen, so to speak, you can leave it as that. And because sitting in meditation, in one way, one you could say, is not a potentially dangerous situation, like a moment of inattentiveness, is not life-threatening for us here. I could see, you know, heads dropping a little bit and so forth. So there's no big cat's mouth which will catch you. Not so dangerous like for the cat, you know, outside our back in our backyard. The bird in the, on our backyard, if there would be cats around, we have no cats around, so even the birds are okay, but still they never lose their vigilance and they never lose their alertness. But we seem to have a tendency, at least occasionally, to sometimes losing that vigilance and alertness and the attention we give to things, what we're actually doing, even if it comes to very simple act as walking or doing very simple manual activities. And for us, it can be, of course, life-threatening in a big city. If we go across a road, a busy road, and we have a moment of absent-mindedness, that can, of course, have severe consequences. That's why when usually the average person moving about in a big city, crossing a main road with lots of cars zooming past, our vigilance and our attentiveness is kind of heightened. Huh? We're there and we're very careful. And so that's good. And of course, in the same way, we could apply that to what we're doing on the meditation cushion, so to speak, in our quiet moments. In a situation like this evening, rather than falling into some kind of maybe meditation habit we have developed of, you know, switching off or half switching off, dimming the light of attention that sometimes happens. And certainly, I'm speaking of experience. So you're not definitely not alone with this. But of course, we don't want this to become a habit pattern, something which takes us over every time we, you know, sitting down in meditation, then we're going into some kind of half trance or maybe even in a full-on trance state. After all, we're here to awaken, and this is not a small thing. It may sound to some of you like a very bold announcement if I speak like that, but there is really no other trajectory for the Buddha's dispensation than that, huh? Simply that, to wake up. And this doesn't have to be some kind of far away, only ultimate goal, which we project into the future. But fortunately, we have the chance and the opportunity to start where we are right now. We don't have to wait for a big awakening experience to come in the future, or when we are better equipped, when we have a more suitable environment. Maybe if you're out there living in a noisy apartment block or so, you might find that these conditions are not very conducive to the awakening process, because there are all sorts of things around you which distract you, which annoy you, maybe even bring up aversion, which you like not to have. But if we have a more broader understanding, then we will see that it's not the noise out there which is causing us suffering, causing us problems. It's the noise in here, isn't it, in the heart, in the mind, which is really causing the problems. That's the problems we're dealing with. I remember there's a very often told story when our teacher Ajahn Chah visited for the first time England, and at that time the first monastery didn't exist yet, so he was visiting London, and there was a Buddhist vihara in London where he was invited and introduced to the Buddhist community at that time. And he was actually giving a guided metta meditation. It must have been a summer's day with the windows open. This was right next to a big main road, lots of traffic. Across the road, there was a pub with outdoor music. There was a band playing. And so, of course, Ajahn Chah was completely unruffled, giving his metta bhavanam meditation instruction. And then after he finished, he asked for any questions. And somebody said, well, you know, this was really difficult. It was really difficult for me to do this metta bhavana meditation here in this, you know, in this environment with all this noise around us. It was impossible. And then Ajahn Chah said, well, you know, I think the problem is that you think that the noise out there is annoying you. But what's really happening actually is you going out there, you annoying the noise. So that was quite a poignant comment. Huh? I wasn't there at the time, so I thought maybe this was some good food for thought for the person. Yeah, I'd never thought about this like that, you know. I'd always thought, you know, circumstances around me, conditions around me, which I don't find agreeable and which, you know, trigger some form of resistance and aversion. They are a kind of impediment to quiet activity like meditation. But it doesn't have to be. Of course, we, you know, I'm sitting here in a monastery, a very quiet monastery, and hopefully you out there also have found a quiet space in your own homes. And we're doing this, of course, intentionally because if you have lots of things acoustically or so, or even visually zooming around you, of course, it tends to absorb all of our attention. And so to seek out quiet environments and one could say protected environments, even one could call it a monastery or retreat center, is offering a laboratory situation where we can look a little bit more close, a little bit more pointedly to our inner experience and explore, you know, what really is the cause for the dissatisfaction, the stress, the suffering we experience in our lives. And if we don't have any kind of really outright strong suffering at the moment from some external event which just happened, we don't carry any strong traumas around with us, which we might need to attend to, then we can delve into the more subtle areas of our experience. And of course, that's eventually, that's where the journey is heading after we've kind of cleared all the kind of pressing issues, so to speak. But then we can attend to the mind directly, and we can see how our minds, our hearts, how they function. And it says, as it says in a famous phrase in the Dhammapada, all things are determined by mind, by the mind, by the heart. The mind or the heart leads the way. Inevitably, if we act within an impure mind, an impure heart on things, react with an impure heart, with an impure mind on things, then suffering will follow us, just like the hoofs of an oxen will follow the good old ox cart, as in this ancient image. Or the vice versa, of course, if we act with a pure or react with a pure mind, with a pure heart to the events around us and inside of us, then happiness, gladness will follow us, just like our own shadow will follow us when we're walking out in the sun having a walk. And so I think probably I would estimate all of you have heard this phrase before, and it's a beautiful phrase. And not by coincidence, it stands right at the beginning of the Dhammapada collections. And it makes us poignantly aware that this really is what we have to take care of. Huh? This mind, this heart, the impure side, which can manifest at times, but also the pure sides, which can manifest at times. So we have both sides available to us. It's not just that we are, you know, born with a kind of impurity, complete impurities. We are born with an incredible potential, and the potential to awaken, the potential to waken would be, I would say, impossible if, you know, our hearts would be completely shrouded in darkness and impurity and in ignorance. And it would not be a flicker of light in there. And it would be impossible to free the heart from those impurities. But as we have also at least a flicker of light, even at the in the beginning moments of our lives when we come into this world, this potential is there. And of course, in the course of our lives, we don't really have a choice what is happening to us. We will not have, we don't have much choice in which society we get born in, which culture we get educated in. We don't have a choice of our parents. We don't know who that's going to be. Fortunately, we don't. We can't think about this beforehand and torture us with thoughts. So should I choose those parents or those parents? Well, those are a bit dicey. I better choose those there. That'd be rather complicated. But we're thrown into life. There are conditions and then the conditioning process of the society around us, of all our caregivers and teachers and so forth, is taking place. And then we eventually are maybe, and I would say ideally, coming across teachings which make us aware of the fact that we don't have to be, for all eternity, be just a product of our conditioning, of our society, of the particular role we play, you know, as men, as women, with that particular conditioning, you know, with the identities we take with our gender, or the identity we might take with our nationality or with our race or whatever. These, of course, can be very inviting, and we all do that in the course of our lives. But who actually would question that? You know, who would question those identifications? There's not many people who actually do that. I remember there's another story about, comes to mind, from Ajahn Chah, where he was asked actually by a woman if women can get enlightened too. You know, it's a kind of a question which keeps recurring because there's so much male dominance if you're reading the scriptures, especially when it comes to awakening process. There's certainly a majority of male beings mentioned. And Ajahn Chah said, no, women can't get enlightened. And then there was this stunning silence in the room. he dared to say that. And then he said, neither can men. Neither can men. Ah, okay. So what does that mean? You know, as long as you're identified with being a man or being a woman, you cannot be awakened. You cannot be liberated. Huh? It's the identification we have and we take with all these different identities, multitude of identities most of us have, which are the problems. Because these identifications happen blindly. They're based on what we call avidya, ignorance. And it's inevitably part of the conditioning process. There's very few beings who are fully aware before the conditioning process begins. I would say there's none of them. In fact, in the Buddhist scriptures, as far as I can remember, the youngest arahant was 7 years old. I have my doubts if this is historical accurate, if a seven-year-old can be fully awakened arahant. But so be it. So these are the stories we hear or anecdotes and so forth, and we can believe them or we can doubt them. But what is really important is that what we can know, as I said earlier, the knowledge which is essential and important for us in the Buddhist context is not so much the cognitive knowledge, the brain knowledge, the left brain knowledge, but it's more what one could call intuitive knowledge or the knowing of the heart, one might say. And if I speak like that, maybe point more to the right hemisphere. And of course, it's not our playing one against the other. We need both hemispheres in our lives to operate, to function. But of course, admittedly, in especially in our Western societies, the left brain hemisphere has been incredibly highlighted and made much of, and education has gone into the extreme, I would suppose, to emphasizing that and neglecting the other side. I would say that's why we're having so many problems right now, with the destruction of the planet, with our climate situation, extinction of species, etc., etc., etc. I don't want to go into the whole cascade of challenges we are facing as a humanity, which are ahead of us. We're not here when we're meeting in this kind of forum, in this context, we're not here to solve the world's problems or the planet's problems. That's something, of course, each and every one of us will hopefully find the adequate response in our own sphere of activity, wherever we are operating in society, our professions, the roles we play, and maybe also the institutions or the organizations we support and so forth. Certainly there's much to be done. But as a practitioner, we take responsibility first and foremost for this, for our own heart, for our own mind. Because this is, as the Dhammapada says, this is where things originate. This is where things arise in each and every one of us, in all the 8 billion individuals on this planet. This is where the pure or the impure impulses arise. This is where greed arises, where hatred arises, aversion. This is where delusion manifests continuously in many, many varieties and forms. But this is also exactly the place where it can be overcome. And so the kind of wholesome karma, which we are encouraged to cultivate, is the karma we each and every one generate. The Buddha never spoke, as far as I can see and remember, about collective karma, the karma which a society or a kind of a hemisphere on planet Earth generates. He was always pointing to the responsibility on the individual. Sometimes, of course, people have been talking like that about the collective karma. So the collective karma of the humanity has led us into kind of a very prickly situation right now. One can maybe speak like that in conventional parlance, but it's not strictly that particular area where we can take responsibility, where we can actually uproot the roots for all the problems we experience and all the delusions and aversions we experience individually. And therefore, we do these things like meditation, contemplation, having an absolutely solid and unquestionable ethical integrity in our lives. No compromises made. This is also, when I speak like that, who can say that in all firmness and all conviction about him or herself? Well, maybe I'm preaching here now to the converted already, as you are all already engaged in Buddha Dhamma, and I'm pretty positive that you all have all your principles and ethical values in place and act and live according to them. But still, now and then, we have to make adjustments, it has to, do little adjustments here and there. And in particular, also, we're not speaking also when we're speaking about ethical integrity, about physical activity or verbal activity, which is usually understood as common sense for most people. But we're also speaking about mind activity, so the mental karma we create, the mental habits we have created in ourselves. And mental habits, I mean the mental habits of our thinking, but also the habits of our emotional life. And particularly, that's the area where we feel the dukkha, we feel the suffering. When sometimes we can have a headache from too much thinking about our suffering, but actually where the suffering hits us is always here in the heart, and it's always in our emotional heart where we feel it, where we get bogged down, where we get despaired, where we get frustrated, where we get sad, where we feel lonely, where we can feel abandoned, and so forth. You know, all the myriad varieties of dukkha we can experience. So that's why, that's where we attend to, huh? In our formal meditations, using a whole body awareness in our meditations. I'm always a little bit skeptical when the instructions are too focused on the concentration aspect of things, when very often how it's understood is that people tend to then very often use the mind energy to concentrate very hard. And it's very very much a mental activity, which very often excludes the body. But if you want to cultivate a whole body-mind awareness, or we could also say live an embodied spirituality or an embodied Buddha Dhamma, to not get too vague, then that also has to come into play. You know, we have to include the body. We get lots of important messages and resonances and feedback from our bodies if we're actually on track. The mind can confirm that later on. It can say, yes, you are on track. This was right. This was good, you know. But as we very often say, the mind, the cognitive mind, is not such a good boss. It's a much better servant. So we let more from this intuitive awareness, from this more expansive awareness and paying attention, let us lead in that way. And then we can, of course, always have a review and give ourselves feedback. How was this? How did this go? Does it need some adjustment? You know, do I apply energy? Is my applied energy too forceful, too contracted, too tight? Or is it too loose and too, you know, am I having the energy of a wet noodle or so? Then, of course, one needs to readjust. One needs to remodify one's application. And then again, we give ourselves over to this more intuitive form of inquiry and pondering and so forth. And that is simply what we're doing. And that is generating karma. It's generating new conditions. We're creating new karma new results. The very activity of giving attention is actually karma. Karma is activity, is volitional action. And then the results, what is the result of that? We can always assess. We can always see, what was the result of this meditation? What's the result of my daily activities? What's the result of my communication with other human beings, even with animals and so forth? You can see for ourselves the karmic result. If we come from a pure heart, an open heart, receptive heart, loving heart even, compassionate heart, that has a vipaka, is the word, the text word for the result of our activities. We can see it immediately. And then we can also take stock and say, yes, that was right, that was good. It had a wholesome benefit. I really want to strengthen that. I want to support that and give more attention to that, because this seems to be good for me in this very moment, actually. So that's the way we can actually observe the law of causality, the law of karma, if you want, very directly, rather than it becoming too theoretical and going into theories about, you know, next lives, next existences and so forth, where this karma we generate in this life will take us to the next life. This, of course, we can only speculate about. But of course, it's not far to, if one wants to speculate and make suppositions, it's not far to assume that which actually has beneficial, wholesome results in this life will also carry on, isn't it? It would be absurd to assume the opposite. Seems quite logical, at least to my mind, that beneficial, wholesome results of our mental emotional activity leads to wholesome results even far into the future. But fortunately, we are not encouraged to speculate about this and bang our heads in order to find out, what the future will hold. We attend always to that which we can really, in all reality, in all directness, it can attend to. And this is always that what we have with us right now. It's never far away, because the faculty of awareness, of this intuitive side of awareness, is never far away. It's always accessible. But in daily life situations, of course, we very often forget. Our attention goes out. It goes out to the world of objects. It goes out to the world of activities. It even goes out to the world of inner activities. We become inattentive to the mental, emotional processes. But as soon as we notice that this is happening, we can always remind ourselves, just a moment of a reminder. Sometimes over time, when we get familiar with this time, with this way of practice, we just need a little nudge. It doesn't even have to be, a thought to nudge us. We don't, look, what's happening now? Oh, there I was, absent-minded for a few moments. Okay. No commentary, no self-commentary, no criticism, definitely. No judgment pass on our maybe lack of abilities and so forth, or let alone lack of potential. We all have the potential, as I said initially. We all have it, brought it with us into this world. And to be born as a human being is always considered, at least in Buddhist circles, as a fortunate occurrence, even a precious occurrence. So we shouldn't downplay that. And this is a chance. Some teachers have put it, in this very life, awakening can happen. And we don't necessarily have to take it into the ultimate sense and as a projection into the future, and maybe look at it more. In this very life, the awakening process can happen. We can, put ourselves in the slipstream, so to speak, of the awakening process. And nobody is ill-equipped to do that. Absolutely nobody. And if you have doubts, and if you have hesitation, and you feel frustrated and so forth, then you have to ask yourself some serious questions. Not too serious, but serious. And so, if anyone wants to speak, I think our host, Sarah, by the way, she's here in the room. And I think she would say that you can unmute yourself. Hmm? Yeah. So if you want to speak, don't even have to wave. Just unmute yourself and there you go. We can talk.
Well, I have a question.
Who's that? Let's see.
Eric? In Freudenstadt?
Yes. Hello. We've met before. Yes.
We have. So Eric, my question is about meditating with powerful emotions and avoiding what they call spiritual bypassing, kind of using meditation to avoid experiencing these emotions. I have some health issues that come every few years, and I thought this would be a good test.
Yeah,
I have thought about impermanence, the universality of suffering, the Buddhist suttas about the universality of suffering, the woman who brings her dead child to the Buddha, and the two arrows, the second arrow of fear and blame. But those visceral emotions, they just, they're like a flood that goes through all these intellectual thoughts that I have.
Yes.
And so I was just curious, it caused me to look at my whole practice again and think, am I using it as a way to avoid these emotions?
Yes. Well, that's a good thought, actually. Yeah. And what was the result of this inquiry?
I think when you have these very powerful emotions that you spend years guarding against, spend years trying not to feel these emotions.
Okay.
Fear, intense anger, a why me, to sit with those emotions, I found it's best to do in small doses. I did find, I think, my practice in between, I might have been using as a way to perhaps rationalize why these experiences aren't that important, as opposed to actually feeling them.
Yes, exactly. Well, you're spot on. That's it. That's a common, very common problem, especially amongst Western meditators. You know, especially as I said before, we are so left brain educated. Our whole education is overemphasized the importance of thinking, of cognitive knowledge, and neglected the other side. You know, where the intuitive side, also where the emotions and feelings are situated. And so you've made a very valuable discovery there, so that you know the danger, bypassing. You don't want to do that because you know that doesn't serve you to bypass any challenges. But maybe what now for you the question would be, how much intensity would you put upon yourself? How much can you handle? Yeah.
Right.
So, because nobody said that you have to kind of head on face any emotional challenge and just jump right into it. Also, in fact, I would really caution you to do that. But especially if it's something which has to do with things like trauma, which I don't think didn't sound like you, that's what you're dealing with. You're just talking about the ordinary
health issues and illnesses
and so forth, you know. Yeah. So then, but still sometimes it can be a good strategy rather than over-challenging oneself with, I should really be present and should attend to this. You're free to always back off, you know, and just allowing it into your consciousness as much as you're able to really hold it with awareness. So if you notice it's just too much and you're getting into stories and again, maybe into the head about it, or you get fidgety and restless and you feel you get overwhelmed, then it's good to back off.
Mm-hmm.
You could do something like a shuttling kind of practice, if you know what I mean, you know? Because very often I've heard people, they feel that when they hear about dealing with challenging emotion, that they should face it head on.
Mm-hmm.
And that can sometimes be counterproductive, actually. Can just have the opposite result, that you kind of ending in more difficulties than you were before you started.
Mm-hmm.
So to have, again, there we have this kind of phenomena again. You have a thing you're kind of dealing with, has a bit more focused attention, but you're also having the context in mind. Huh? You also, you know, how am I with this, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a more kind of larger context, and then you will find out also what the quality of your attention is like, for example, you know, or if you're kind of trying to force the issue, things like that you will be aware of, and then you can modify the way you're dealing with any particular challenging emotion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense?
It does. I think that's what I've been finding in my own practice.
Oh, well, good. Then you could have told me that.
No, well, it's a work in progress. I do find it interesting how, you know, you can read a lot of Buddhism and you can kind of intellectually understand it, like
until the cows come home, as we say here in this country.
But when you're actually sitting, it's easy to forget all that.
Yeah. It absolutely is. I know what you mean. Okay, so all the best to you in Freudenstadt. Hope you will have some joy in Freudenstadt in the next few days over Christmas and the new year and beyond, of course.
A bit of snow, as you probably have.
Lots of snow, very enjoyable. Yeah.
Thank you.
Don't have to have a question, by the way. If you have a comment, you can also add something and you know, okay. Make this richer, what I have said tonight.
One question. Can you hear me?
Victoria, yes.
Hello.
Hello.
One thing about you said before, noise. I get very disturbed with noise. My neighbors, especially when I'm trying to meditate at home, it's like a nightmare. What can I do?
Yeah. Oh. Well, remember that was not a joke. The story I told you was not a joke.
There is, no? Like bumping doors.
Oh.
Yes, I don't know what they're doing. I get angry.
Oh, yes. Well, then you are annoying the noise.
Okay.
When you get angry, when you allow yourself to be taken over by anger. Of course, yes, it is. I mean, commonly speaking, it is annoyable. It is irritating if neighbors or people up above don't have a sense of, well, how it might affect you. Of course, one way to approach the issue would be some good action. So when you're really feeling very good in yourself, metta fully switched on, you go upstairs, knock on your door and kindly ask them, you know, if there's something, or ask them if something which could be done about this. So it's not, you know, there's not just the way of gritting your teeth and enduring or so forth, or watching your mind. That's, of course, yes. At the end of the day, you always have to look after your own heart, your own mind, that you don't get constantly triggered into the state of irritation and aversion.
Yeah.
But it's also, we can also be proactive and then carefully, of course, because people can, of course, be very reactive.
I know.
Have you already spoken to them?
Yes.
You have already. Okay.
I don't know what to do. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Then if they cannot, if that cannot be changed, then you have only two choices.
Yeah.
Either move out of the house.
To the country.
Or take full responsibility for the irritation. I can really empathize with you. That's not a small thing, because I've lived in places like that, which had been very noisy when I was living in cities. And eventually I moved out of the city. I only entered the city as a meditator for 3 years, and then I had to move into a quieter environment. Yeah. So that's, of course, definitely a thought worthwhile. But as long as you're there in your flat at home, please take good care of your reactivity, your reactions. Don't get negative because of the noise. Because really, Ajahn Chah was right. You are annoying the noise whilst you're thinking all the time that the noise is annoying you. But the irritation is here in us, isn't it? It's not nowhere else. The people up there, they're quite happily making noise.
I know.
I'm not thinking of you, probably, when they're doing that. So, yes. That's all I can say, really.
Yes, and thank you.
Yes. Okay, Victoria. I wish you well. Yeah, which is also some joy in the next few days and beyond.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
This is Nisar. Ajahn Khemaseri from Palo Alto, California, and I want
really?
To bow to you.
That's a surprise. Very
I want
good
to bow to you.
Oh, wonderful. How did you come to this session here? Who brought you here?
Well, I've been following Dhammapala. I've been wanting to come back. I can visit, but because of the virus, I cannot. And I'm so happy to catch English version, and often the time is a problem because but today the time is just right for me. It is lunchtime here.
It's just, you just had your lunch, I guess, huh?
So good to see you.
I hardly recognize you because your hair got so white.
Right. Thank you. I'll come back Dhammapala as soon as the travel restrictions are over. I hope so.
Yes, we're all praying, aren't we? We're all praying intensely that this will be over soon. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be really lovely to have you here again. Yeah.
Thank you.
All the best, Nisar.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Palo Alto, California. So anyone not so far away from Dhammapala wants to speak? Probably that's the furthest away you can be tonight.
Anshan Kimasiri, here's Caroline.
Caroline, yes.
Hello.
Hello.
It's about the question of noise. I'm talking about another noise, more an inner noise. I had the chance of slowing down my life the last 2 years very much, which also calmed down the inner noise.
Yeah.
So now I started to increase my activities again, work and other stuff. And, well, the inner noise is increasing with it. And I totally realized that...
We're surprised, huh?
and I just realized that also in my formal practice, it becomes very noisy and distracting also. It becomes very hard to just stay in the present moment and not have all these thoughts. I mean, they are always there, but it was when I was slowing down, they were slowing down. And now I'm increasing and it's increasing again. So maybe you have a good hint about how to cross it, increasing my activities in my everyday life, but trying to get this slowing down inside me that I had the chance to live the last few months.
Yes, right. I can. Well, I think it's a little unrealistic to expect that the same kind of quality of, you know, mental activities slowing down, so you're better able also to stay in touch, you know, and be connected with it. And in daily life, you have to expect that this, because it's still what's the expression? It's still a conditioned state, you know, to rely on the state you experienced when you were here in the monastery or you were on retreat and so forth. So these are all dependent on conditions. Now, when you're out there and engaged with various activities, you can't control the conditions any longer. There's so much more stuff coming at you. So, yeah, what you do. I think you have to just adjust to this new situation, and maybe you're putting also an unnecessary measuring stick up, you know, and comparing unnecessarily with how it was before, but adjust yourself to the new situation. You know, there's more activity, mental, also emotional activity probably going on. And it's just maybe a little unrealistic to expect that from you, you know, putting also undue pressure on yourself to reach that same level as you had it before. That's usually always a recipe for suffering if we compare how it's been, you know, last week, yesterday, or even just a few moments ago. And so what is your reality now? So if your reality is now an increased level of activity, an increased level also of reactivity maybe, then, you know, try to be aware of that, but not in that kind of one-pointed way. Again, we're coming back to this theme of the one-pointed attention and the more broader attention of what is actually happening. So the context is also in view, the context in which you are acting, living, and in which you're actually experiencing your life, you know. And so that in daily life, to expect a very kind of high-level mindfulness or awareness or form of consciousness, maybe it's a little bit asking a little bit much of you. What do you think?
Yeah, thank you. As often probably I'm just way too hard on myself.
Pardon?
As often I'm probably just way too hard on myself, right?
Hard on yourself. Yeah, it sounds, and knowing you a little bit, it sounds a little bit familiar, yes.
Yeah.
But it didn't sound too hard this time. It just sounded like maybe a little bit an unrealistic expectation, you know, put it like that, you know. But yeah, it could be a hidden form of, you know, putting up again a high measuring stick for yourself, which you cannot reach, you know, however hard you try.
Yeah.
So lower that measuring stick and see what is possible within the sphere of, you know, your abilities and also the, you know, considering the environment you live in, you know, the noise around you, as the other person was saying, you know, there's a lot more noise coming at you probably also. So.
Thank you very much.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So if there are no more people who want to add something to the mix, then I would propose that we call it a day.